كلمة حلوة وكلمتين حلوة يا بلدي غنوة حلوة وغنوتين حلوة يا
أهلا وسهلا بكل الذين انضموا للاستماع إلى راديو بلدي أول راديو عربي أمريكي يجمع في بث حي ومباشر ولاية ميشيغان شيكاغو وينزر كندا ويعنى بقضايا العرب في المهجر. برامجنا في راديو بلدي كل يوم جمعة من 8 حتى 9 صباحا مع ليلى الحسيني وريح حنانية في بث حي ومباشر من ميشيغان وشيكاغو عبر WNZK راديو 690 AM و WJJG 1530 AM. لما اتصال بنا الرقم 708-493-1530 أو عبر الويب سايت عبر www.radiobaladi.com. صباح الخير بلدي، صباح الخير لكل مستمعينا في ميشيغان وينزر كندا وشيكاغو.
Welcome to Radio Baladi, the first Arab, Middle Eastern and American simulcast radio show linking Dearborn, Chicago and Windsor, Canada on the radio throughout the world with our live broadcast at radiobaladi.com. Radio Baladi is broadcast. Same time in Chicago on WJJG 1530 AM from 7 to 8 Central Time on Radio Chicagoland, hosted by Ray Hanania. Our call-in numbers in the Dearborn region are 248-557-3300.
Good morning, Ray. How's it going?
Hey, James. How are you? I don't know if you could hear me okay, but I was having some sound issues there. How's everything?
Okay, yeah, you're coming in all right. This is Jim here and breaking new guy Anthony, and good morning, and welcome to Radio Baladi, everybody.
And it's a Jim and Anthony show today, so welcome to Anthony and Jim. I appreciate it. All right, well, good. As long as everything is coming in okay, I guess we're doing good here. There were little computer issues the last couple weeks. So welcome to Radio Baladi. I'm Ray Hanania. Here at WNZK AM 690 in Detroit, it is August 10th, 8:04 in the morning. A lot of neat things happening. In a little bit, we'll be talking with Hussein Ibish about all the different things that have taken place in Egypt and Syria in relations between the Palestinians and the Israelis. But I don't know if you've been keeping tabs on the Olympics. The Arabs have actually been doing pretty well when you think about it. They've actually gotten 10 medals, which I think is phenomenal. This is the 100th year, by the way. And I was a little surprised that the Arab world didn't do much with respect to the Olympics. I thought, okay, maybe they could do more. But they didn't do much. And I wrote some columns, which you could probably read when you go to my website at RadioBaladi.com or RadioChicagoland.com, but it is the 100th year marking the entrance of Arab countries into the Olympics. It started in 1912 at the International Olympics competition with Egypt. Since then, I think we have today, as of this writing, I think it's 17 Arab countries. There were actually now in the Olympics 100 years later. And as of writing the column, there were 10 medals that we've received this year. 1 gold, 3 silver, and 6 bronze. Algeria's Taufik Mekhloufi took the gold medal in the 1500-meter race. The first medal was actually won by Nasser El Attaya of Qatar. In men's skeet shooting, it was bronze, not gold but or silver, but bronze. And the first female athlete from Saudi Arabia made her entrance to the Olympics running in a track competition, Sarah Attar, who's both American and Saudi Arabian. She wore a hijab and clothing that covered her entire body, save her face and her hands. And maybe that alone had to be a pretty big handicap for a track runner in London's sweltering heat. It might explain why she came in last. But you know what? Even if Sarah Tarr did come in last, she's a hero in my book. And we should celebrate the fact that, we're always slow 100 years, really, 100 years, we should be dominating the Olympics. We should be up there fighting with the United States and the Chinese, who are going back and forth over who's going to win the most medals and who's going to win the most gold medals. So it's kind of sad, but I think the total number of all of the gold medals, as of this writing, we had Algeria with one gold medal, Egypt with two silver medals, Tunisia with one silver and one bronze medal, Qatar with two bronze medals, Kuwait one bronze medal, Morocco one bronze medal, and Saudi Arabia one bronze medal. Other countries that were in there that won nothing were Iraq, Jordan, Bahrain, Lebanon, Libya, Yemen, the United Arab Emirates, Oman, Palestine, and Syria. But then that's not too bad because Israel hasn't won anything either. Ha 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 ha. Yeah, the Israelis didn't win anything. And this is competition, after all. So it would have been interesting to see the Arabs against the Israelis. But the Israelis kind of frown on that a little bit. They're all upset because nobody acknowledged officially, you know, the commemoration of the 40-year anniversary of the terrorist attack at the Munich Olympics in 1972, which was at the height of the Palestine-Israel wars. It wasn't like it just came out of the blue, but of course the Israelis want to make it look like they were just killing Jews all over the place and Israelis, and that's not true. There was a retribution attack against the Israelis, sadly, at the Olympics after the Israelis destroyed two Christian Arab villages in Palestine, which was occupied by Israel. And the children of the people that were killed were among the Black September group that attacked the Olympics. Now, I don't think it was right to attack the Olympics, obviously, but to just make it sound like it's just about the Israeli athletes without even ever mentioning the fact that Palestinian civilians were murdered and killed by the Israelis and that their kids were prompted to seek revenge, that would have been unfair. So I think a good moment of silence at the beginning of the Olympic ceremonies would have been to acknowledge the 11 dead Israeli athletes and also to acknowledge the 1,500 Palestinians who died before that in the two villages, almost 180 people, and after that in retribution and assault by the Israeli to punish the Arabs for attacking Israel at the Olympics. So that would have been the proper way to do it, and of course Israel wouldn't allow that. They, you know, they don't want anybody to know about what they're doing. So, you know, that's just the way it is. Fortunately, the Olympics didn't cave in to the Israeli, you know, intimidation. And they went ahead and just continued the opening ceremonies as they were. But all that aside, I think the Arabs have done pretty well. And I'm pretty proud of what they've done. And I think we could have done a lot better. I tell you what, let's do this. Let's take a break right now, and we will talk about, hopefully, when we get back from our break with Hussein Ibish, our guest, who's going to talk about Egypt, circumstances in Syria, and how far the relations have deteriorated between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and what impact will the new elections in Syria have in the region. I'm Ray Hanania. And Jim, why don't we take a break right now, and when we come back, we can continue this discussion at Radio Ballady. We'll be right back right after these messages.
Jake's Candy, two for $1 candy bags and $1 candy bags available. Wholesale and distribution. Jake's Candy has been satisfying the sweet tooth of thousands of people for over a decade. Now providing delivery service to Columbus, Cincinnati, and Dayton, Ohio, as well as Rochester and Buffalo, New York, and New York City. For New York service, call Sully at 718-213-1264. Or for more information, call Jake's Candy at 248-747-2223. That's 248-747-2223. Good news. As of November 17th, Immigration has been given new instructions to review and close all pending cases. If you're in immigration proceedings, call attorney Stephen Lagana at 617-283-1018. Free consultation for Michigan residents. Mention Radio Bolody. For the latest in immigration law, Stephen Lagana specializes in immigration and federal court proceedings. Visas of all kinds, deportation, court appeals, open refugee status, and much more. All immigration cases are currently pending review. It's time to get the right attorney working for you. Call immigration attorney Stephen Lagana at 617-283-1018. Mention Radio Bolody. That's 617-283-1018.
يا مسبتي هي بنترفين حد خد فرح ولا ايه انا ما شفتهاش من 3 ساعات بنتي حبيبتي طب هنعمل ايه نكلم البوليس ولا الجيش انا بيتهيالي ان قناه الاخبار تحت في الشارع طب هو شعري شكله كويس يمكن يصوروا فيلم عننا اخوك يعرف وكيل افلام كويس مش كده طب مين اللي هيلعب دوري غاده عبد الرازق بيتهيالي انها مشغوله في فيلم جديد ولا ميريل ستريب يمكن تاخد جائزه اوسكار كمان على الدور ده دي حتى ممكن
وليه فرح في الحمام بتتكلم في التليفون
إذا كنت من عشاق دراما لا تبحث في مكان آخر في رمضان ديش أرابيك تقدم لك NBC دراما مع المسلسلات الدرامية المشوقة اشترك في ديش أرابيك سوبر باك اليوم واحصل على 3 شهور مع بلوك باستر وقنوات أفلام HBO والسينماكس والشو تايم والستارز مجانا لمدة 3 شهور وأيضا بصفتك عميل ديش إذا زكيت صديقا تحصل على بطاقة مكافأة بقيمة $75 وإذا زكيت 5 أشخاص تحصل على ما يصل إلى $375 لمعرفة المزيد اتصل ب 415-922-8888 أو قم بزيارة dish-arabic-tv.com وقريبا NBC للأطفال عدد لمدة محدودة قابل للتغيير دون اختيار تطبق القيود على تفعيل خدمة العميل الجديد متضمنة اتفاقية 24 شهر استلام بطاقة المكافأة يستغرق من 6 إلى 8 أسابيع للتوصيل تطبق الرسوم والشروط والأحكام والقيود على استخدام بطاقة المكافأة
And welcome back to Radio Ballady. I'm Ray Hanania here. We also have a little ad we want to promote for Dish Network. They have the largest selection of Arabic programming, top channels such as Al Jazeera, ART America, NBC Drama, little bit of what you heard, and more. Our package includes a mix of channels for every member of the family. They have news for fathers, cooking shows for mothers, drama and serials for daughters, and cricket for the kids. They have the largest selection of religious programming for the month of Ramadan. You can feel at home with Ramadan with the Dish Network. They also have the largest selection of news programming covering every minute of the developments in the Middle East. Their offers are very simple and really good. Subscribe to the Arabic Elite Super Package that is over $44.99 and automatically get the following for free. 3 months of blockbuster movies, $75 in American Express reward cards, HBO, Cinemax, Showtime, and Stars for free for 3 months, HD Life and free, HD DVR for free, and they charge you zero for installation. To top it off, if you refer a friend to Dish, you get $75 each, and up to 5 people, you can get $375. So remember, the Dish Network. Go to Dish Network at DishArabicTV.com or call 888-262-2674. We're hoping our guest, Hussein Ibish, will be calling in very shortly, and we're waiting for him. Hussein is a scholar who is very familiar with all of the events in the Middle East, and I'd love to have the guy on. I'm just going to send him a quick reminder that he should be calling, so we get him on the line. Let's see, please call. And if you want to call, by the way, at 248-557-3300, we want to hear what your opinions are about the Olympics. Have you been watching the Olympics? Are you excited about the Arabs doing very well? A lot of the columnists have been critical of the Arabs, saying that they haven't been doing well. But I'm pretty optimistic. I'm pretty happy that, with what the Arabs have done at the Olympics. And I'd like to see more. Because, some people say, well, what's the difference? Why should we participate in the Olympics? It is a perception thing. Why compete in anything? Competition is good. There are a lot of other things, besides Arab literature. We have very skilled athletes, many of them. So we want to showcase that because it does promote Arab pride. the Olympics would be like the Super Bowl, at least for Americans. The Super Bowl every year is the big TV event. Millions and millions of people watch the Super Bowl. And to have an Arab American on one of the Super Bowl teams would be phenomenal if that would ever happen. But I think the Olympics would be great. And, you know, we might even get to the point, although I guess the cultural problems we have might stand in the way. One, it's during Ramadan, so that would make it very tough, you know, to compete and yet fast all day. So, like Sarah Attar from Saudi Arabia, fasting all day, not eating, you know, until late in the evening, until iftar, and then, you know, trying to catch up. That would be very difficult for an athlete to compete against others. Now, she ran in the, I think it was, I can't remember if it was the 1,500 or 100 meter. Maybe it was 200 meter. But she came in last, and it looked like, you know, she struggled a little bit. And, you know, being completely covered in that heat with a hijab and, you know, track outfit, you know, covering everything except her hands and her face, that had to be very inhibiting. Yet she still did it. Yet she still tried very hard. I doubt that we would have too many competitors enter the volleyball sand competition, which has been dominating the TV. All they wear are skimpy bathing suits. And I'm not sure how the Arab world would go over about seeing Arab women in skimpy bathing suits. Personally, I don't care. I think that, you know, this whole thing with dress is irrelevant. And I know that for the very religious, I understand it. But I don't think everybody, you know, the religious should dominate our world. I think they should have a say, just like the secular should not dominate our world. I think we should let everybody do what they want, dress the way they want. Be respectful of others. If somebody wants to wear a hijab or even a burqa, we would respect it. But if somebody wants to wear a bikini and wants to play volleyball and represent one of the Arab countries, I think they should. And while we hear that, you know, in the Arab world, we hear people say, oh, well, we respect Western people who dress. The truth is that I think if we had an Arab woman who was in volleyball, and we got a lot of sand in the Arab world, so, you know, you could play sand beach volleyball if we really wanted to in the Arab world. I think a lot of the Arab world would go up in arms and be more angry about that than they would be angry about the Arab-Israeli conflict. They'd be angry to see an Arab woman represent the Arab world in a bikini playing volleyball. And to be honest with you, I would be more upset with the people who were upset, because I think that that is the way that we need to, you know, change the way we're perceived. We can, you do whatever you want in your home, you do whatever you want in your country, you know, you live your life, but you don't impose your life on others. That's always been an issue in our community. Jim, I think we're going to take, we have two more breaks. Why don't we take our second break right now? You want to do that? And then when we come back, I think Hussein will be calling us in a few minutes, and we can get him on the phone line to give us an overview of Egypt and Syria and the Palestine-Israel conflict. So why don't we do that? Why don't we take our second break this morning here at Radio Ballady? Our number is 248-557-3300. Our website is RadioBallady.com. Let's take that break, and when we come back, we'll hopefully have Hussein Ibish on the line, and we can talk about some of those issues. I'm Ray Hanania. We will be right back right after these messages.
Whether it's makluba, warak dawali, tabbouleh, hummus, mensif, or any of more than 1,000 great Middle Eastern recipes, Ziad Brothers Importing is your best source for Mediterranean food products. Ziad Brothers Importing distributes products under the Ziad name and also many other labels, such as Sultan Extra Virgin Olive Oil and Dana Lebna and Dana Cheese. Try their ready-to-serve microwavable instant side pilafs, including couscous with tomato sauce, roasted green wheat pilaf, cracked wheat pilaf, and rice and lentil pilaf. All tasty, natural, healthy, and authentic Mediterranean dishes from the microwave to the table in minutes. Ziad food products are available at all major food and grocery stores in Dearborn, Chicago, Windsor, Canada, and around the country. If you can't find the product you want, just ask your grocer to stock them. For more information on food or recipes, visit Ziad Brothers Importing online at www.ziad.com. Ziad offers the best Mediterranean food products from our family to yours.
يا مسبتي هي بنت فين حد خطف فرح ولا ايه انا ما شفتهاش من 3 ساعات بنتي حبيبتي طب هنعمل ايه نكلم البوليس ولا الجيش انا بيتهيالي انه قناه الاخبار تحت في الشارع طب هو شعري شكله كويس يمكن يصوروا فيلم عننا اخوك يعرف وكيل افلام كويس مش كده طب مين اللي هيلعب دوري غادة عبد الرازق بيتهيالي انها مشغوله في فيلم جديد ولا ميريل ستريب يمكن تاخد جائزه اوسكار كمان على الدور ده دي حتى ممكن
يا فرح في الحمام بتتكلم في التليفون
إذا كنت من عشاق دراما لا تبحث في مكان آخر في رمضان ديش أرابيك تقدم لك NBC دراما مع المسلسلات الدرامية المشوقة اشترك في ديش أرابيك سوبر باك اليوم واحصل على 3 شهور مع بلوك باستر وقنوات أفلام HBO والسينماكس والشو تايم والستارز مجانا لمدة 3 شهور وأيضا بصفتك عميل ديش إذا زكيت صديقا تحصل على بطاقة مكافأة بقيمة $75 وإذا زكيت 5 أشخاص تحصل على ما يصل إلى $375 لمعرفة المزيد اتصل ب 415-922-8888 أو قم بزيارة dish-arabic-tv.com وقريبا NBC للأطفال عقد لمدة محدودة قابل للتغيير دون اختيار تطبق القيود على تفعيل خدمة العميل الجديد متضمنة اتفاقية 24 شهر استلام بطاقة المكافأة يستغرق من 6 إلى 8 أسابيع للتوصيل تطبق الرسوم والشروط والأحكام والقيود على استخدام بطاقة المكافأة
Jake's Candy, 2-for-$1 candy bags and $1 candy bags available. Wholesale and distribution. Jake's Candy has been satisfying the sweet tooth of thousands of people for over a decade. Now providing delivery service to Columbus, Cincinnati, and Dayton, Ohio, as well as Rochester and Buffalo, New York, and New York City. For New York service, call Sale at 718-213-1264. Or for more information, call Jake's Candy at 248-747-2223. That's 248-747-2223.
And welcome back to Radio Ballady. I'm Ray Hanania here at WNZK AM 690. We're here every Friday morning from 8 until 9 o'clock Eastern in Detroit and the Detroit region. Our phone number is 248-557-3300. You can call in and talk to us about anything you want. We were talking a little bit about the Olympics, and you know, I'm a little, there's been a little criticism by a number of Arab writers. You know, they've been very harsh on the performance of Arab athletes in the Olympics, and I've read a number of columns where they've been very critical. But I take the exact opposite, you know, approach. I'm very excited about the performance of Arab candidates in the Olympics. We only have 10 medals, but, you know, out of 17 countries, with Algeria getting the gold, that's not unusual. Tunisia getting silver, Egypt getting 2 silver medals, Qatar and, and Kuwait getting bronze, Morocco bronze, and Saudi Arabia bronze. I thought I saw another one there. But and then there are countries that got none, that received none, unfortunately. Iraq, Jordan, Bahrain, Lebanon, Libya, Yemen, the United Arab Emirates, Oman, Palestine, and Syria. But then, of course, the Israelis didn't get any. So I guess if you're Arab, you know, getting 10 medals, you know, as an Arab people, while the Israelis got none, okay, there's a little victory there. We could go ahead and celebrate that. Not in a mean way, but let's turn to our guest now, Hussein Ibish. Hussein is a senior fellow at the American Task Force on Palestine. He was born in Beirut, Lebanon, and he's actually 10 years younger than me and 20 years smarter. This guy is brilliant. I admire his thinking process and the way he is able to analyze all these issues. And I think we should always take advantage of people like that to help understand what's happening in the world. Hussein, welcome to the program this morning, and thank you again for joining us.
I appreciate it. It's good to be with you.
No, you're a great guy, Hussein. And, you know, every time I do a search for you on the Internet, I come up with names like Ziad Asali, who is a great guy from the American Task Force on Palestine, but also Jeffrey Goldberg, Peter Beinart. And I wonder, do you ever tussle with those guys like Jeffrey Goldberg?
Oh, sure, yeah. I've had public arguments with him and also public agreements with him. So tussle, for sure, but it's always, with Goldberg, it's respectful because Goldberg understands fundamentally that the occupation is not in Israel's interest, the settlement project is not in Israel's interest, and he favors peace based on two states. So once you start from that rational perspective, you can have a respectful conversation, differences notwithstanding. And I think, you know, it's just very important to be willing, if you're interested in ending the occupation, to talk to any Americans.
Right.
Where they, no matter where they begin from.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. But sometimes I read his columns, I get really angry, but I think you make a very good point. Sure. If the starting point is fairness and an objective we agree to, that's good.
The other thing about Goldberg is that, while I don't agree with him a lot, I know a lot of people who don't agree with him a lot, and he's an unpredictable person. And I think the worst thing you can say about a columnist or a commentator is that they're predictable, is that you know what they're going to say before they said it, or you can take a very good guess as to what they think before they say it, and they almost never surprise you. Those people are not worth reading, not because their views might be wrong. They might be really right.
But you know what they're going to say.
Yeah, exactly. Why would you bother reading them when you know what they're going to say?
That's good. And, he's the one that gets under my skin every once in a while, and sometimes it's very hard to take some of the stuff he writes, but I think you make a great point that it's important to put this in perspective. How about Peter Beinart with his Crisis of Zionism?
Yeah, I quite like that book, actually. I mean, I sort of got sneak previews and some input.
He took a lot of criticism, didn't he, from the American Jewish community?
I like the book. I think its strongest chapter is the one I know least about, which has to do with Chicago and President Obama's interaction with the Jewish community in Chicago. Overall, I think the book is quite good and raises some very important
strong points and issues.
And it's interesting to see, you know, the Beinart coming from sort of the center-left sort of liberal tradition is ending up making much the same arguments as Norman Finkelstein, who emerges from a kind of far-left Maoist tradition. And they've ended up in the same place because they've looked at the same facts as Jewish Americans who are concerned about these things and said, good grief, this is where this is going. We have to do something about the way things are.
Yeah, and Norman Finkelstein, he's an interesting person. I've gone back and forth with him, but he seems to have changed a little bit over the years. I don't know if you've been reading his stuff more recently, but he's shifted a little.
Well, I think he has, and I think so has Beinart, and they've ended up, interestingly, in more or less the same place, although they probably wouldn't want to admit it. Their tone is very different. Their language is very different.
Right.
But if you look at what they're advocating, it's more or less the same thing.
And let me ask you about, obviously, have you been watching the Olympics? Before you came on, I was giving a little review of the Arab world performance. I think we've done pretty well. We have 17 Arab countries participating in the Olympics. This is the 100th year of Arabs being at the Olympics. We started, I think, in Stockholm in 1912 with Egypt. We only won 10 medals this time, but I think we're now a total of 89 through the whole century. But it's still not enough. I want to see even more. And I wonder, you know, some people will say the Olympics, oh, come on, that's a waste of time. But isn't things like the Olympics important to the Arab world and Arab culture, too?
Oh, sure. Oh, of course they are. And the fact that I'm so personally not watching a minute of it and deliberately and publicly doesn't change the fact that people care about it. And
right.
It's important.
And I didn't mean to put you on the spot there, Hussein. I just figured
listen,
it was
totally. It's totally fine. Because what I'm really not doing is I'm really not watching TV. It's got less to do with the Olympics themselves rather than what I would have to do to watch them. And I've kind of been trying not to watch television and enjoying not watching television, believe it or not. So.
Well, a lot of people would say that people would be better people if we didn't watch as much TV as we do watch.
I don't know. I just enjoy life more.
Yeah, well, I think that's absolutely what you should be doing. But now, what I was hoping you would do, if you don't mind, give us kind of an overview about what is happening, what do you see happening in Egypt, and what do you think will happen? And then give us, if you don't mind, a little overview of Syria and then the relations between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Start with Egypt.
Okay. With regard to Egypt, do you mean Egypt's internal political situation, or do you mean with regard to the Sinai Peninsula? Because those are overlapping but different things.
Well, I mean, you know, for just the person watching, it can be a little troubling and happy. It's like we have so many mixed feelings. It's great to see democracy there, but then there seems to be tension.
Sure, I get the idea. Okay. Well, I mean, I think in Egypt there's good news and there's bad news. The good news, let's start with the bad news. The bad news is there's a power struggle within a society that's badly divided along at least four different axes. There's the existing state institutions and the holdovers of the former regime, including the military on the one hand, but also the existing sort of government institutions and bureaucracies, which have similar but not exactly the same interests, and that's one group, and their supporters. Another group, of course, the Islamists, the Muslim Brothers in particular, and their supporters. A third group, and a kind of sort of street protesters and self-styled revolutionaries and liberals who have power in the streets but no organized ability to, say, turn out the vote or anything like that. And the fourth group, which I think is probably the biggest, is the big mass of Egyptians who just want jobs and a better economy and some law and order. And there's a power struggle going on between the existing institutions and the Islamists that and this is going to be protracted, and it's going to be bitter. That's the bad news. The good news is that it's a peaceful power struggle. It's a political power struggle, largely played out, I might say, in the courts, actually, even though the arguments are only ostensibly about law. They're actually about power. But neither side wants to take this out of the realm of, let's say, the legal world, you know, things in parliament, decrees, interpretations of court orders, continuous lawsuits and things like that. So, you know, Egypt moves forward in fits and starts. It's not making as much progress as quickly in a smooth way as in terms of the political development of a new system as Tunisia, certainly, which already held its elections for the Constituent Assembly, which is taking 6 months to write the preamble for a constitution. But that's a very important thing. A preamble to a constitution sets up everything else. The fact that they took 6 months is less a sign of paralysis and more a sign of the intense struggle over the language, which is not a bad thing, frankly. And what they ended up with is perfectly okay, in my view. And I'm fussy about human rights and freedoms and things. But I think it's all right. I think you can begin with a preamble like that and end up with a good constitution. Or even in Libya, where the old NTC that led the uprising against Gaddafi yesterday handed over power to the new Constituent Assembly, which was elected a month ago. So, you know, in a sense, Egypt's travel towards a new system is a lot more sort of four steps forward, three steps back, if even that, than the other two post-dictatorship societies I just mentioned. But it is also still moving forward, and, you know, that's sort of the good news.
So it's okay to see this process of our own kind of democracy forming in the Middle East in a very slow and deliberate way.
Yeah.
There's no way of rushing into it, and Egypt is much more of a significant country, I think, so it might take even longer than others. So, but you still see it moving forward in the right direction.
Yeah, I mean, Egypt is a bigger country. It's a more influential country, but it's also a country with a much more deep and complex political history than Tunisia,
right,
or especially Libya, which has, you know, had almost, you know, no civil society. It's interesting. I mean, Tunisia never crushed its civil society, so it's moved. I mean, it sort of stifled it under Ben Ali, but it never crushed civil society. There was always a civil society in Tunisia, and I think that has helped Tunisia, you know, sort of snap out of it very quickly. In Libya, there was no civil society at all. There wasn't even government. There was just sort of nothing. There was Gaddafi,
right,
and everyone else. And so that, in a sense, has helped them move on because they don't have competing existing institutions. They just have nothing. Well, they have oil and they have some people, but the one thing, another thing the Libyans have going for them is money. Egypt has a very complicated socio-political environment, and as I said, a very disunited country. So the fact that it's sort of taken them a long time is not necessarily an alarming thing. Speed in these matters isn't necessarily optimal.
Right.
Slow development, if that sloth can prevent state disintegration or violence or anything like that, is a worthy is a necessary evil.
And what about for those people who are out there who may be looking at, you know, strictly from the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and I've heard many people say, well, the Egyptian military, really the U.S. has great influence over them because of all the money we pump in there. The Israelis have influence. How are those factors in reality really playing out, do you think?
I don't think either country has almost any influence. I mean, the U.S. The U.S. connection to the Egyptian military is because they cannot leverage that aid. That aid is contingent on it's linked to the peace treaty with Israel. The U.S. cannot consider, you know, tampering with that aid without putting something extremely important to American policy in jeopardy. So they know we're not going to do that. And most of it's dedicated. A lot of it is basically for getting the Egyptians to buy our goods and services. So it's kind of a roundabout subsidy to American contractors and their employees. So it's not, you know, it's not like we can really sort of leverage that. I think the bigger form of leverage over Egyptians the United States has to do with World Bank and IMF, especially IMF loans and bailouts.
These would be for other projects that they may want to pursue.
Well, exactly, and that's for their budget, and that's
right.
Really a whole other story. And in that case, we didn't want to do that, so we didn't really use that as pressure. Israel, I think, has almost no influence as well. And I honestly, what's happening in Egypt is really very much an internal Egyptian thing. And I think that the one group of people that has shown its ability to influence things in Egypt are the militants and extremists in Sinai who attacked Egypt's soldiers and have forced certain political moves by President Morsi and military moves that otherwise Egypt wouldn't have made, because they attacked Egyptian interests. And they've also forced the Israelis and the Egyptians to look again at their security cooperation, and both sides say it hasn't been this strong in a long time, even though you have a
political debate.
No, you have an Islamist president in Egypt, which many people had expected, especially Israelis, had expected and predicted would have a more hostile relationship with Israel. As a matter of fact, that's not the case, because Egypt's interests haven't changed. And in fact, its incentive to cooperate with Israel militarily and coordinate in places like Sinai and along the border is greater than ever because of the fact that 15 Egyptian troops were killed by extremists. The Israelis and the Syrians, by the way, the Israelis and the Egyptians, by the way, have found that because of this attack, their arguments against each other over Sinai have both been reinforced. The Israelis have been telling the Egyptians, you need to do more to enforce security. That obviously has gotten bolstered. The Egyptians have been saying, well, how can we do that if the Camp David Treaty enforces a demilitarized zone in the north, that you have to let us bring in troops. So I think their point has been made, and both of them have to look at each other's complaints in a new sympathetic light. They can't sneer at them anymore. They used to sneer at each other, and now they suddenly take each other very seriously and see the point.
I wanted to kind of go to Syria, but let's shift over to the Israeli-Palestinian issue. How does what's happening in Egypt impact what is happening between Israelis and Palestinians? Is there a direct impact, or is it the same one that we've always seen, and it's really between...
I think it's more or less the same, and I think it boils down to this, which is Egypt does not have a new foreign policy. I think Hamas was expecting that they would. With the Muslims.
A lot of people were, I think, either hoping or, trying to push or argue, but it hasn't changed, has it?
Fearing, sure.
Yeah,
no, people were hoping or fearing or predicting. They were excited or fearful, or that's analytically what they thought. They were all being naive. What they didn't understand is that Egypt's foreign policy was driven by Egypt's role in the region and Egypt's the strategic equation that any Egyptian leader sees when looking out at the region around them. And, you know, it's fine when you're in opposition to use all these slogans and to believe ideological things that you may really believe and say all kinds of stuff. Once you're in power, April Fool, you're in power. And you've got responsibility for your country. And, you know, now you have to listen to generals and intelligence agencies and experts saying, look, if we did that, this will happen. And here are our real options. And here are the consequences to the country. And you just can't behave like, you can't abandon decades of foreign policy that were rational and based on really existing national interests because you have a different ideology. And so Egypt's foreign policy under Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood hasn't changed because its interests haven't changed. And Hamas in particular, and here's the only real big impact, I think, on the Palestinians. I think there isn't any impact on the Israelis because they're familiar with that foreign policy and they like it. It accommodates their interests.
Right.
Hamas was expecting, was the biggest group or the biggest cheerleaders expecting a new Egyptian foreign policy, and they were counting on it. And even they've had to accept that for all the announcements about opening the Rafah crossing to all traffic, that hasn't happened. And in fact, the Rafah crossing is closed altogether now. It will be reopened to limited traffic as it has been since the downfall of Mubarak soon, but it's going to remain human traffic, and it's going to be limited, and that's just the way it's going to be. And it's not, you know, the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood is not going to transform the role of Hamas in Palestinian politics and not going to create a situation in which Hamas is able to overcome the nationalist leadership in Ramallah, the PLO and the PA, and take control of the Palestinian movement, which is what they were hoping. And they were hoping in vain. If anyone misread the situation in Egypt, you know, more grotesquely than Hamas, and they did it in desperation, I might add. I mean, they were pinning their hopes on the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt because they didn't have any other hopes. But really, it was a false hope, and it was always clearly a false hope.
And does that weaken or strengthen the government in Ramallah, you know, of Mahmoud Abbas?
Well,
how's he doing?
Well, I'll tell you what, not well.
Yeah, because the talk is all about the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas. It isn't about Abbas and Egypt.
Right. Well, no, yes. I mean, in that sense. But look, in terms of their own credibility, and particularly the presidency, but overall, the PA has suffered enormously because it's been seen to be ineffectual. It's been
right.
seen to be increasingly autocratic, I think, is a fair comment.
Right.
And with, you know, ever more limited inputs into decision making. I mean, there's still a vibrant civil society in the West Bank, but it's paid less attention to by the especially the presidency than it used to.
And it's vibrant in spite of the government.
Yes, vibrant.
Yeah.
Well, in part because of the government is not also a unified thing. There's
right.
There's some interesting splits there, but the other thing about the PA leadership in Ramallah is it has a financial crisis because the West has cut its aid by half. And Arab donors are not delivering on their pledges for the most part. So they're unable to meet salaries on a regular basis. And they're only getting less than half of the international input they need for fiscal year 2012. So they're in a total economic crisis. And their whole pitch was, you know, sort of, first and foremost, we pay your salaries. Public sector employees are the biggest bulk of employees in the Palestinian territories. Well more than 1 million Palestinians directly dependent on those paychecks, including
right.
in Gaza. Most of the public employees in Gaza are paid for by the government in Ramallah. If they can't meet payroll, which they've had difficulty doing, now they say that on Monday they're going to be able to meet payroll again for most public sector employees, but it's really a week-by-week thing for them now. That undermines their main sort of appeal, which is, look, we provide a rational government that delivers goods and services, and we are not crazy fire-breathing guys, and we will get where we need to go incrementally, slowly, but in the meanwhile, your lives will improve. That's been the pitch for when it worked for a bit, but it
right.
doesn't really work when you can't meet payroll.
So you got it. You have to have the money. You have to continue. The economy still has to be doing well. Is it a economic problem, or is it a political problem? And why are the Arab governments kind of holding back a little bit?
I don't know why the Arab governments are holding back. There was a report that in the United States was pressuring the Arabs not to deliver their aid, but that they traditionally haven't, so they don't really need American pressure to do that.
So it's just a good cover, though, for them.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in a way it's a genuine crisis, and in a way it's a manufactured crisis. It's a genuine crisis because Palestinian economic development, everyone has always admitted from the beginning, was highly dependent on foreign aid. There isn't a robust private sector economy in the occupied territories. And as the world recent July 25th World Bank study showed, there are, the main reasons for that are the Israeli occupationist restrictions and the fact that the Palestinian economy is still too dependent on international aid. And they urged education reform to create more critical thinking and analytical thinking among Palestinians to make them better private sector employees, to build a more robust private sector. But that means both have to, you know, to both the Israelis and the Palestinians have to do things to get there. So in that sense, it's real, but it's manufactured in the sense that things were okay until, you know, everyone knew that, as Salam Fayyad, the Prime Minister, says, they still need a slightly more than $1 billion a year from the outside world for their budget. That's half of what they needed a few years ago. He's done a great job of reducing dependence on foreign aid while at the same time increasing spending. But there's a bottom line of at least $1 billion from the outside that's needed to do things like meet payroll.
Right.
And now they're getting about half of that, you know, and they're not even receiving those. The Gulf states, as I said, are not giving, some of them are not giving the money. And U.S. aid, which is cut to about half of previous levels for fiscal 2012, is under congressional hold again, just like the fiscal aid from 2011, which we saw in a number of holds that was finally released because President Obama and Secretary Clinton overrode those holds, which they can do, eventually. And so, in a sense, I mean, I think the outside world is punishing, especially the Americans and the Europeans, are punishing the Palestinians for the UN bid of last September, which failed. It didn't even get a majority in the Security Council to prompt a veto. It was a complete...
They're going to try it again, I hear, next month.
No, they're going to try something different. What they're contemplating, they can't go back to the UN. It's the Security Council because they didn't have a majority then to even provoke a veto.
Right.
And they certainly don't have that now. So what they're talking about is going back to the UN, but probably after the presidential election here. So after November, in all likelihood.
Oh, okay. Well, that'll...
Coming under very heavy pressure from the United States to wait. And what they are talking about doing is going to the General Assembly and becoming a non-member observer state. Okay. Now, that would have, as far as I can tell, exactly no practical effect. I don't see what prerogatives or rights would much change for the mission, the PLO mission, in New York, and I don't think it would do anything to improve realities on the ground. So I'm worried about the cost. I mean, I'm not sure it's a bad idea. I just worry about the cost benefits.
Right. The plan isn't laid out very clearly, is it? It doesn't seem like it's clear what the benefits would come.
To me, it isn't. And I've been asking a lot of people, and I get, you know, sort of gibberish when I ask. I mean, I get symbolic stuff. So I get that this would be, you know, a useful symbolic victory. I understand that. And
so people would feel good about it, but in reality, what would it bring? Hussein, I got to ask you just to...
Cost. I would be for it. But I want to know the cost benefit before I...
Hussein, I'm going to ask you if you just hang on for 1 minute. I got to do one final break. And when we come back, maybe we can talk a little bit about Syria before we end the show. But it really is a pleasure to have you on the show. We're talking with Hussein Ivish, who is on the line with us, helping us sort through all the many different activities and events in the Middle East. You know, he's a senior fellow at the American Task Force on Palestine. He's from Beirut, and he's going to sort through maybe Syria with us. But we're going to take a break here real quick at Radio Ballady. We got our final break we need to take at Radio Ballady, WNZK AM 690. Also, you can go online at RadioBallady.com. And I would also remind you to please tune in on Sunday mornings in Chicago from 8 to 10 Central for Radio Chicagoland, where we talk about little bit about a mix of mainstream American politics and local issues, and also some Middle East issues. I'm Ray Hanania. We're going to be right back with Hussein Ibish to talk about Syria right after these messages.
The American Muslim Center works for the community. It establishes goodness, virtue, and develops relationships between the Muslim communities as well as regional and national non-Muslim communities. The American Muslim Center on Outer Drive in Dearborn. Call 313-565-9314 or visit AmericanMuslimCenter.org.
يم سبتي هي بنت فين حد خطف فرح ولا ايه انا ما شفتهاش من 3 ساعات بنتي حبيبتي طب هنعمل ايه نكلم البوليس ولا الجيش انا بيتهيالي ان قناه الاخبار تحت في الشارع طب هو شعري شكله كويس يمكن يصوروا فيلم عننا اخوك يعرف وكيل افلام كويس مش كده طب مين اللي هيلعب دوري غاده عبد الرازق بيتهيالي انها مشغوله في فيلم جديد ولا ميريل ستريب يمكن تاخد جائزه اوسكار كمان على الدور ده دي حتى ممكن
وليه فرح في الحمام تتكلم في التليفون
إذا كنت من عشاق دراما لا تبحث في مكان آخر في رمضان ديش أرابيك تقدم لك ام بي سي دراما مع المسلسلات الدرامية المشوقة اشترك في ديش أرابيك سوبر باك اليوم واحصل على 3 شهور مع بلوك باستر وقنوات أفلام اتش بي او والسينماكس والشو تايم والستارز مجانا لمدة 3 شهور وأيضا بصفتك عميل ديش إذا زكيت صديقا تحصل على بطاقة مكافأة بقيمة $75 وإذا زكيت 5 أشخاص تحصل على ما يصل إلى $375 لمعرفة المزيد اتصل ب 415-922-8888 أو قم بزيارة dish-arabic-tv.com وقريبا ام بي سي للأطفال عقد لمدة محدودة قابل للتغيير دون اختيار تطبق القيود على تفعيل خدمة العميل الجديد متضمنة اتفاقية 24 شهر استلام بطاقة المكافأة يستغرق من 6 إلى 8 أسابيع للتوصيل تطبق الرسوم والشروط والأحكام والقيود على استخدام بطاقة المكافأة.
SibioMedia.com is a wellspring of media arts. SibioMedia.com tells God's story through short films, drama, poetry, music, and the internet. And you have free media downloads. Go to SibioMedia.com and listen to Nasheed, based on the Psalms of the Prophet David, for free downloads in several Arabic dialects of stories, short films, poetry, and music. Go to SibioMedia.com.
Icon Computer Megastore. Mention Radio Baladi for great deals. Computers and laptops from $99. Apple computers from $129. Warranties included. Shipping available. Free layaway plans. Arabic to English keyboards, $5. Mouses, $5. Repairs for iPods, iPads, Apple computers, and PCs. Icon Computer Megastore on Greenfield, north of Warren Avenue in Dearborn. Mention Radio Baladi. Call today, 313-582-3100. 313-582-3100.
And welcome back to Radio Chicagoland. I'm Ray Hanania. We only have a couple minutes left, actually two, and that's not a lot of time to give us a capsulized version of Syria from our, even as great of a guest as we have, Hussein Ibish, but I'm going to give him the challenge. What can we say about Syria in 2 minutes or less?
Okay, first of all, we have what we've seen is a popular uprising in the countryside and the small towns that morphed into an insurgency based in the countryside that converged on the major cities recently in a kind of a Syrian version of the Tet Offensive. It's likely to fail militarily, but I think it signals the eventual outcome of the conflict. And the countryside has come into the cities now, Damascus and Aleppo in particular. And in Aleppo, what has happened is the insurgency has morphed into a civil war. Rebels are fighting to hold territory for the first time. They're fighting with heavy weapons for the first time. And all the momentum, I think, is on their side. The government still is overwhelmingly powerful. But their great strength, which is their military power, the sophistication of their weaponry, the number of troops they have, and the sophisticated troops commanding control, all of that's eroding over time. Their weakness, which is a lack of depth within the population and sort of eroding resources, are becoming greater while their strength is becoming eroded. On the rebel side, their weakness, which is a lack of military sophistication, sophisticated arms, command and control, are all getting stronger. And their weakness, their strength, which is depth, does not seem to be eroding, and it might even be growing because everything the government does to suppress the uprising only makes the rebels stronger politically. So in that sense, I think we see the momentum very much on the rebel side. On the other hand, the question, given the fact that I think the government is bound to fall at some point, is what comes after? Can Syria remain united? And the answer to that is not really, in the sense that how fractured it is, How much state disintegration we see is very much remains to be seen and depends on how long this takes. The quicker this is over, the better for everybody. But really, like, absolutely everybody. Nobody, no community, and no large group of people, I mean the government, I suppose, maybe, but in nobody other than the inner clique, including here the Alawite community, nobody benefits from dragged-out conflict, in which you're starting to see the Balkanization or Lebanonization of Syria into different enclaves, and particularly the new sort of quasi-autonomous Kurdish region that's been established in the north, but you also see the regrouping of different communities, including the Alawite community, their enclave on the northern coast, and things like that. So there are a lot of exposed and vulnerable people here, and in the end, I think the likelihood is whatever you see coming out of this, there are two points. One is, even if Assad goes and the regime falls, the fighting will probably continue, because you've got communities that, like especially the Alawite community, but there are others, who really feel that they're in an existential crisis and they can't afford to compromise and they'll keep fighting. The second thing is that you're unlikely to see at the end of the day the same kind of integrated, unified Syrian state that's existed since independence ruled by Damascus. I don't know how much state disintegration we're going to have, and I don't know what it's going to look like. Is it going to look like Lebanon or Iraq or Bosnia or Somalia? I don't know. But I'll tell you this, I just don't think the old Syrian state, unified and centrally ruled from Damascus, is going to survive this.
And on that note, I'm going to, of course, another brilliant observation. Hussein Ibish is our guest. Hussein, I would love to see the American Task Force on Palestine, especially you, come out to Chicago and even Detroit. We would love to do whatever we can to help you guys bring some of these messages that you're talking about on radio. You got a wonderful column. I believe it's ibishblog.com. Am I correct?
Yeah, it's been actually hacked a bit, but I'm trying to bring it back up. But I think where people can read me is Now Lebanon and The Daily Beast.
All right, Now Lebanon and The Daily Beast is a big achievement, too. Congratulations for that. Hussein Ibish, my guest. Hussein, thank you so much for coming on and joining us today.
Appreciate it.
All right. And I want to thank everybody for joining us and listening here at Radio Ballady, WNZK AM 690. Go to our website at RadioBallady.com. I'm Ray Hanania. Have a great weekend. We will talk to you later. Bye-bye, everybody.
WNZK, Dearborn Heights, Detroit, your ethnic superstation at 690 days, 680 nights.